This podcast is sponsored by Alt Legal. Alt Legal, easy to use IP docketing with powerful automation, deadline calculation, and reporting.
Hello and welcome to the Alt Trademarks Podcast. I'm your host, Hannah Samendinger. On this episode, I was joined by Radiance Harris. Radiance is the founder and managing attorney of Radiance IP Law, which is an exclusively flat fee law practice based in the Washington, D.C. area. She provides outside general counsel services to startups and emerging companies with a focus on trademark law, copyright law, advertising law, and business contracts. Before starting her solo firm, Radiance worked at DLA Piper and Kelly IP, representing Fortune 500 companies. You can find out more about Radiance's practice online at radianceiplaw.com. You can also find out more about Alt Legal on Twitter at AltLegalHQ and at AltLegal.com. Thank you for joining us and enjoy. Hi, Radiance. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Hannah. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. So I guess we'll get started sort of at the beginning and learn a little bit more about you as a practitioner. So at the very beginning, after college, you went straight to law school and then worked at a couple of firms, including DLA Piper. So can you speak a little bit to how you decided to go to law school and how you ended up getting involved with intellectual property?
Sure. So I was one of those individuals who's known that I wanted to be a lawyer since high school. I was around 14 or 15 years old. Actually didn't have any lawyers in my family. I am the first lawyer in my family, but we had a family friend who was a lawyer, and he just made it seem like the coolest thing ever. And he's really the one who got me into being interested in the law, and he still serves as my mentor today. So basically everything that I did since high school was basically preparing me to go to law school. Fast forward to law school, I went to University of Maryland for law school, and during my time there, I happened to have summer associate positions during my first year and second year of law school. My first year was at Whiteford, Taylor & Preston, and then my second year was at DLA Piper. And during that time, I was able to sort of dibble and dabble in a variety of practice groups, but ultimately, I knew that I had an interest in entertainment law per se. I didn't really know what that meant, but I knew that I had an interest in it. And while I was sort of experimenting in different practice areas, I absolutely fell in love with trademark and copyright law. And fortunately for me, I was offered an associate position out of law school in the trademark, copyright, and media group at DLA Piper. And the rest is history, really.
And so now you have your own practice and you provide a lot of outside counsel to startups and other companies. So how did you decide to make that move?
Sure. So I decided to make that move for the most part because I've always been very entrepreneurial, but didn't really quite understand what that meant. For example, when I was at my previous law firm, my colleagues who I'd worked with would comment on how entrepreneurial I was while there, being that I was always very much a go-getter and out there writing articles and doing all those things to sort of build myself and work on business development in addition to billing, you know, the 2,000 plus hours a year. So from that point, it took a few years for me to realize that I was really ready to thrive and be on my own, mostly because, to be honest, I was tired of working for someone else and having to practice law the way that they wanted to wanted me to practice law, because essentially that happens when you're working for someone else. And so I found a great opportunity to spread my wings, per se, and launch my own practice. And the model is very much, I guess I would say, forward thinking, in that it's technology driven, it's an exclusively flat fee model, and it's very much based on value instead of time. And so I just thought it would be a great opportunity to start my own practice and help startups and emerging companies with very specific areas of practice. Mainly trademark law, copyright law, advertising law, and business contracts are my focus. And so I'm actually over a year in of having my own practice, and it's been very exciting.
Were there any things that when you opened your own practice you found that were sort of unexpected, things that either in a good way or in a challenging way, but things that either you didn't maybe perhaps didn't think of before you opened the practice, or once you got going, you're like, oh, I wish I would have known this before I started off on this venture?
The one thing that comes to mind for me is because I knew once I launched my practice that I really wanted it to be an exclusively flat fee model. So I didn't want to have the hourly rate. And so I would say that the main challenge for me is coming up with flat rates that are, you know, fair and reasonable and inclusive. So I'm one of those attorneys where I don't bill clients for every single phone call or email or things like that. As I'm working with them, I try to price the package in a way that's inclusive of that. And so sometimes that can be challenging for me, is like how to fairly and reasonably price it so that the client can budget accordingly, but also so that I can be fairly and reasonably compensated for my time and my work. So I would say that has been one of the most challenging trial and error experiences since launching my own practice.
Yeah, I can imagine it's sort of an undefined area. So you have to learn as you go.
Exactly.
Yeah. Are there any things that surprised you in a good way, like your favorite parts about owning your own practice?
What surprised me in a good way, I guess the sort of the freedom that comes with being in charge of your own business. And surprisingly, I don't necessarily work as much as I did when I was at other law firms, in that I'm in charge of my schedule. So I can work as much or as little as I want to. And I can focus on being efficient and productive instead of just being busy for the sake of being busy. So that's a very rewarding aspect that I've enjoyed. It's just sort of the freedom to be my own boss and be in charge of my schedule and how I work with clients.
Yeah. And so you're mostly focused, correct me if I'm wrong, on startup companies as your clients. So,
correct.
Okay, great. So how did you decide to narrow, like how did you decide that was an ideal client base for you?
Sure. So, you know, after working with Fortune 500 companies for a number of years prior, I realized while doing that often I was initiating lawsuits or sending cease and desist letters on behalf of these big corporations. On the other end, there were always sort of these smaller emerging companies that were on the receiving end. Mm-hmm. And for me, I realized that either these emerging companies couldn't afford counsel, were ignorant to the fact that legal is a very important part of what they need to do, or perhaps I thought they would fall under the radar and not get caught. And so when I launched my own practice, I knew I wanted to help those startups and emerging companies stay out of the courtroom and get their legal house in order. And so that has been my focus since then. I find that, you know, the larger companies already, they have their in-house legal teams. They kind of already know and have their established sort of legal protocol internally, where the startups are now sort of creating that. And so I love being a part of growing, helping them at the ground floor as they grow and helping them establish their culture, but also protecting their legal aspects of their business as well as they grow.
And I imagine one of the challenges with finding those clients, but also with opening your own practice, is that you really have to put yourself out there. So unlike at a large firm or a company, you're running a business and finding these clients and handling the legal work all at once. So in advance of this call, we talked a little bit and you told me that you're an introvert, which I imagine brings, you know, a unique set of challenges to this type of venture. So can you speak a little bit to what it's like being an introvert who's trying to open a practice and do these sort of entrepreneurial tasks, and what any tips and tricks that you use as an introvert to sort of put yourself out there and handle those challenges?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. And yes, I'm an introvert, though. People are always surprised when I say that because they're like, you're not an introvert. And I'm like, yes, I am. I just know how to be a fake extrovert, so to speak. But what I will say is that as an introvert, it's definitely very I guess you would say easy to thrive as a solopreneur because, you know, you can easily focus and get work done without having other interaction around. So in terms of being very productive, that's a very positive aspect of being an introvert. But I will say that business development can be a challenge. And while for me, most of my business has come from word of mouth and referrals and things like that, it's still very important to plant seeds and develop new relationships and very much get out there. And so some tips and tricks that I kind of force myself to do that other introverts could also hopefully learn from is for starters, it's important to really step outside of your comfort zone. A lot of times people or fellow introverts want to say, oh, well, I'm an introvert or I'm shy, so I'm not going to do that. But it's very important to do things that you normally would not do because that's the only way you're really going to thrive, right, is if you challenge yourself. And so stepping outside of my comfort zone is huge. And I always try to figure out what is one thing each day that I can do to make me uncomfortable, to squirm a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then another thing that I do is really kind of focus on maximizing our strengths as introverts. Like being an introvert isn't a bad thing. There are a lot of positives to being an introvert. And so really focusing on that, the fact that, you know, introverts can often be very great writers. So what are some opportunities where you can get out there and publish work and just, you know, write to make yourself an established thought leader in your field. Another strength is that we thrive better in sort of smaller events or one-to-one situations. And mm-hmm. so just being smarter about networking. So I typically won't go to like events where it's like a huge room with hundreds of people and you're kind of just mingling throughout. That's not my my strength position, but something a little bit smaller, like an intimate lunch or one-to-one sit down with someone for tea or coffee. Those are my strengths. So I try to really focus on those things. And also things such as this, as a podcast where you have one-to-one interactions with people where they can get to know you and you can get to know them. That's another way where we can maximize our strengths because that's where we really thrive is in smaller settings. And then lastly, I always make sure that I'm deliberate in what I do. So for example, you know, I challenge myself to at least do two in-person meetings a week or one speaking engagement a month or one article a month. So I try to set goals where each month I'm going to do at least this. And what I find a lot of times is that each of the months I end up doing more than that, but at least I've established for myself and challenged myself to meet those sort of minimum thresholds. So I would say that those are the main tips and tricks that I've used personally to start and grow my own practice.
Yeah, those are great. I think sometimes, I mean, just speaking for myself, but sometimes it's hard because you think that networking or some of these, you know, professional obligations come only in certain forms. So like networking, well, you have to go to the big events and you have to go to these conferences, but there's lots of other ways to do it that you can play up to your strengths. So I think that's a really interesting way of framing it that's helpful for people who, you know, find those situations to be, you know, not as productive.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't be afraid to, you know, bring a friend. A lot of times you can actually, if you bring a friend along to a networking event where you typically may be uncomfortable at, you'll find that you're a lot more comfortable. You're actually able to make it a productive event versus just kind of standing in the corner looking for the next person to talk to. So also another kind of tip or trick is to don't be afraid to bring a colleague or a friend along to help you feel more comfortable as you're, you know, connecting with new people.
Yeah. And then, so touching on one of the things you mentioned, which is writing, in advance of this interview, I also was doing a little research and I found you're a very prolific writer. You have a lot of interesting articles online about a variety of IP topics and topics in the legal space. And so I wanted to ask you a couple questions about one of them that I thought was particularly interesting, which is an article about the protectability of hashtags. Hashtags are very popular on social media, I guess in particular on Twitter. I know that I usually think of them as something that's more temporary and sort of fleeting, like, you know, maybe there's a hashtag that's trending for an afternoon, but I haven't really thought about it as a protectable form of IP, but some people are seeking trademark protection for them. And I'll link to a couple trademarks for hashtags in the show notes, but I guess as a way of sort of background, can you just speak a little bit to how this works? So if there are any special considerations if you're trying to trademark a hashtag, and how the USPTO is handling those applications at this point.
Sure. Yeah, so with hashtag trademarks, a very important thing is to realize is that that hashtag has to function as more than just sort of a social media tracker or tool. Normally a hashtag is used as an online categorization tool. It can be used, it's on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And so that alone clearly does not constitute trademark use. However, where that same hashtag is used beyond the social media platform, so it's used as an actual source identifier for actual products or services. So in other words, it's on the front of your store, it's in-store displays, it's used on your website, it's used in print and advertise and digital advertising. It may also be used on actual products and merchandise. Only then does it become an actual trademark, when it's actually used as a trademark. And so in 2013, the USPTO, that's when they recognized hashtags as registrable trademarks, so long as they function as source identifiers of the applicant's goods or services. So, you know, just like any other trademark, if the word if the word or a signifier that cannot function as a trademark without the hashtag, then it wouldn't function as a trademark with the hashtag. So basically the same traditional trademark rules apply to hashtag trademarks.
And has the USPTO, I mean, to the extent that you know of, been allowing these trademarks, or has there been any sort of pushback or anything like that when they've been reviewed by the examiners?
I mean, there's been quite a surge in hashtag trademark filings. Like, you know, as of 2015 alone, there's been like over 1,000 hashtag trademark applications, and the USPTO has granted a number of them. You know, the ones that have clearly shown use of the hashtag mark in connection with actual products or services have been approved for registration by the USPTO. However, there are a number of other ones where the marks were descriptive or the applicant failed to file acceptable evidence of use, in which the USPTO denied registration. So, you know, it can go either way, but typically if you apply for the hashtag and demonstrate that it's actually being used as a trademark, so you're submitting evidence of actual trademark use and not just use on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, mm-hmm. then more times than not, your trademark would be accepted by the USPTO.
And you touched on this in the article that you wrote, which I'll also link to in the show notes, but there are some questions surrounding enforceability. So why is it that it may be difficult to enforce your rights in a hashtag trademark? Why has that come up, the questions surrounding enforceability?
So hashtag trademarks is new. It's a new sort of area. It's a new category of trademark. So it is unclear how courts will treat hashtag trademarks in the future because it's a new thing. So on the one hand, we've got one case, which is Fraternity Collection versus Fagnoli, in which the court basically said that hashtagging a competitor's name or product in social media posts could, in certain circumstances, deceive consumers. So in there, they recognize that the hashtag may, in fact, be actionable if it's competing with a competitor's name or product. On the flip side, we've got another court case, Exousian versus Albanese, in which the court says that hashtags are merely descriptive devices and are not protectable as trademarks. So as you see, we've got two very distinct opinions on the enforceability of hashtag trademarks. So it's kind of up in the air of how courts will could potentially treat hashtag trademarks in the future.
It's interesting. And I'll link to both those cases in the show notes as well, so everyone can review them. And I guess we'll just keep an eye out for future cases that give a little more clarity to the enforceability of hashtag trademarks.
Absolutely.
And then to wrap up our interview, I'm just going to ask you a series of rapid-fire questions that have a little less to do with being an IP attorney and a little more about who you are outside of your practice. So they're just for fun. You ready?
Sure. Let's do it.
Okay, great. So what's your favorite app that you use on your phone?
Favorite app? Okay, well, actually two come to mind, so I'm just going to share two. They're both of them are business related. The first is Circle Back. Love that app because it keeps track of my contacts, so I no longer need like that shoebox full of business cards. I can all put them in the Circle Back app, and it also updates them using email captures. And then the second app that I absolutely adore is Mile IQ, which helps me track business mileage. And so instead of having to manually do it, the app does it for me.
Oh, that's nice. And where do you get your IP news?
Mostly get my IP news. I have a bunch of Google alerts set up. So daily I'm getting alerts on different IP topics discussed in various news sources. So that's the primary way that I get a lot of my IP news. But I also am an avid reader of the American Bar Association's Landslide magazine.
Mm. And what's the best piece or just a good piece? I know sometimes it's hard to pick the best one of advice that you've ever received.
The best advice I've received is work smarter, not harder.
That's a good one. It's sometimes easy to forget, but it's certainly a good one to keep in mind.
Yes.
Who's a woman, professional, or, you know, just a personal relationship that you look up to?
Woman I look up to, I have to say, and I'm just going with the first thing that comes to the top of my mind, and it's Oprah Winfrey. How can you not look up to Oprah Winfrey and all she's done? She's a billionaire. She's built this empire from scratch. So how can you not love her? So I'll go with her.
And last one is, what would you be doing if you weren't an attorney?
I think I would be a professor.
That's a good one. And that's it. So thanks so much for joining us, Radiance. Do you have any general parting words of wisdom for the listeners?
Sure. I would just say to always stay open-minded. Don't be afraid to try new things and constantly challenge yourself to step outside of your comfort zone. You'll be amazed how much you will grow as a person and as an attorney, just by being open-minded and not afraid to try new things.
And if anyone wants to reach out to you and talk to you more about anything, any of the matters you spoke on, what's the best way for them to reach you?
The best way to reach me would be email. My email is rharris@radianceiplaw.com. Feel free to also check out my website, which is www.radianceiplaw.com. And also on social media, if you're on social media, I can be found at Radiance Harris on Twitter and IG, and also have a Facebook page, Radiance IP Law.
Great. Thanks so much, Radiance.
Thank you, Hannah.
That's this week's episode. Thank you for joining us, and see you next time.